Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 8th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santamaria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I want to thank those of you who support the show week after week and ensure that it is 100% free to download for anybody who wants to do so. The best ways to support the show are to visit my website, karasantamaria.com, and click through the links. You'll find the web store, which is also at talknerdymerch.com. You'll find clicks to rate and review via any podcast program that you use, like Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Stitcher, Spotify, all the different places you download podcasts. And of course, you can pledge your support financially by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy, or you can click through from my site. This week's top patrons include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Scott Sanders, Leonard Prince, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so, so very much, not just from me, but from all the listeners of the show. All right, let's get into this week's episode. This week, I had the opportunity to sit down, well, virtually, of course, with Dr. Pia Sorensen, a senior preceptor in chemical engineering and applied materials at the John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Ooh, that's a mouthful, at Harvard University. She is all about the science and engineering of food, with specific focus on microbial processes and chemical processes of fermentation, the science of flavor, and understanding the ancient history of food. And of course, she is a master of public science communication and education. Her newest book is called Science and Cooking: Physics Meets Food from Homemade to Haute Cuisine. And so without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Pia Sorensen. Well, Pia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am very excited to talk about your new book, Science and Cooking: Physics Meets Food from Homemade to Haute Cuisine. I have to tell you, this is, first of all, I know I'm going to be hungry as I'm talking to you today because I haven't really eaten much. But second of all, I think I might be just the right person to be talking to you about this book because I love science. I've been working in academic science and also in public science communication for, you know, 2 decades now almost. But I have to admit, I'm not a big fan of cooking. And maybe my mind will be changed as you and I talk about the science of cooking, because I've never really thought to conceptualize cooking through a scientific lens.
Oh, that's so cool. I actually like that you say that, because I have definitely seen that happen, where people get so intrigued by the science that they go home and they try things and they're like, oh my God, I just made kimchi, or I just cooked a steak and this thing that you said was going to happen, it actually happened. So maybe, I guess we'll see by the end of this.
I hope so, because I'll tell you what, like, I talk to people who have an intrinsic love for cooking, and I would love to know from you if that's something that was fostered from a young age, if it's something where you've always been drawn to the kitchen and to, you know, trying to understand why ingredients do what they do when you apply heat or when you apply acid. But I have long been the kind of person who sees food as fuel. And although I really do enjoy eating in a social setting, and I love, you know, going to a restaurant with a good friend. God, I miss those days. Oh, COVID. But I love going to a restaurant with a dear friend and really engaging over good food. When I'm at home living alone, you know, food for me or meals for me have long been a means to fuel. And so it's like, I always had this rule that I should never cook. I should never take more time cooking something than it takes to eat it. So I might prepare a Thanksgiving dinner because it takes all day to eat, and it's okay that it takes all day to cook. But for me, sitting at home alone, if I know I'm going to eat my whole meal in 20, 30 minutes, I don't want to cook anything that takes longer than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I think true. So I may disappoint you in a way, because I was growing up, I was surrounded by a lot of cooking. People in my family cooked a lot, and some of the people in my family were involved in kind of raising animals and raising crops. So it was kind of, it was there. And I think I've always had an interest in food, but I'm not one of those kids who was like making a, multi-story cake at the age of 10, served to my, no. So I think what drew me into the science of cooking actually is, so maybe I would say it's two things. One is that, I think it was a sense of curiosity. I think that is not just sort of, oh, me, I'm so curious. I think people in general are curious about the world around them. And I think for me, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm trained in the sciences. I grew up being curious about things. I grew up being curious about, especially nature and plants and birds and trees and that kind of thing as a very young person. And then I think from there, being curious about food was kind of another way to be a scientist, but in a different way. So I think on the one hand, there is this sense of curiosity, being curious about the ingredients in cooking and in food. But also for me, what really got me hooked was as a grad student. So for my PhD, I studied natural products, small molecule natural products. So these are the small molecules that occur naturally in plants that sort of extract and use. Eventually, sort of the long-term goal is to use them as drugs, but you can also use them to understand various cellular processes. And so I studied those molecules, and this was, you know, very typical kind of pipetting, synthesizing molecules, growing HeLa cells and applying these small molecules to those and seeing what happened. And my favorite part was sort of as a break from the lab work was to go and teach. I love teaching these introductory life sciences courses, and what kept being this thing was, well, here are these students. How do I explain this concept? How do I kind of nurture that curiosity that brought them into the classroom in the first place? And then food kind of appeared on the scene as this thing to do that with. And so that is, I think, sort of as a older scientist, no longer the kid running around in the woods, that was the thing, that using food as a teaching tool to teach science.
Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, it's such a perfect way to get people in, because so often, well, everybody eats, first of all, and most people cook or at least source their food somehow in order to be able to eat. It's so fundamental to the human experience. And of course, we know that science is fundamental to the human experience as well. But there are still, as we all appreciate, big barriers to access to scientific information. There are, societally induced, and now even more than ever, I don't want to open up that whole can of worms, but as I think you know what I'm getting at, there's a lot of distrust around science. There's a lot of fear around science. Science has been politicized in a major way. And so having some sort of common concept to utilize to help explain these concepts, to tell these stories is absolutely brilliant. It really does crumble a lot of those walls. I have to ask, before we get into the actual book and actually your role at Harvard and how those things are connected, you mentioned that you were studying these small molecules. Were you, was your PhD in biochemistry? Like, what did you study to get into this sort of area?
Yeah. So as an undergrad, I studied biophysics and did crystal structures of RNA. And then for my PhD, I was a chemical biologist. So I've kind of constantly been at this interface of chemistry and biology. And now in a way I still am. And I think one thing too that I've sort of realized recently as I'm having kind of mentoring conversations with students is one of my favorite parts of being an undergrad, which is now a long time ago, but one of my favorite parts of it was that I was not only a scientist, I could also take all these other courses, which is kind of, you know, the American education system. I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Sweden, where after high school, you go and study one thing. And so the opportunity to be able to take classes in literature and linguistics and history was really amazing to me. And I think in a way, what I do now, when I think about sort of science as a way to kind of at the interface of food and education and the interface of food with so many other subjects, there is this sense in which I've sort of brought the liberal arts back into what I do. So I think that's a really cool thing about thinking about food in general in an academic setting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's so multidisciplinary. And of course, as somebody who is a teacher and also a public communicator of science, having that that interest and that understanding, at least, or that hunger, I guess you could say, for the, like you mentioned, the liberal arts, for history. I mean, these are all components of the scientific method, the scientific story within public education. So you're at Harvard, you're in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and your title, is this a Harvard thing? You're a senior preceptor in chemical engineering and applied materials. What is a senior preceptor? I've never heard that word before.
That's a great question. It's a typical Harvard thing. Harvard likes to have words for things that, for, you know, different words for things that are called other things in different places. So a major at Harvard is called a concentration. And I am a teaching faculty. So I teach more than I do research, but I do both. Yeah.
Ooh, what a cool job. So often that's not even available to professors at certain universities, especially within the sciences. There's this real pressure to publish and to do, you know, to basically do research, and teaching is not really prioritized.
Yeah, that's true. It's a really wonderful position for me to have. It's fun.
I love that. And I mean, it really does speak to, you know, as you mentioned, your joy and your love around kind of communicating these ideas in a way that is meaningful to the students. And so tell me about the class or the classes that you teach that sort of, I guess they predated the book, right? The book came out of these courses that you teach and sometimes co-teach?
Yeah, that's correct. So I teach courses that in various ways teach science with food. So the course that the book is based on is called Science and Cooking, same as the book. And it's been around since 2010 and was started in collaboration with some quite famous chefs and Harvard researchers. And so the whole idea of the class is to basically realize that whenever we cook, when we cook basic things, you know, mac and cheese in your kitchen, meatballs, whatever, even just boiling pasta for that quick meal that you mentioned that you just want to feed yourself, all of those recipes are based on science. And when we decide to, you know, when you make that quick decision, I'm out of salt. Maybe I shouldn't add any salt to my pasta water today. Is that going to matter? We kind of make these calculated decisions that are really sort of based in science. And whether they work out or not can be explained by science. And that's true for you and me when we cook in our kitchens, but it's also true for these really cutting edge chefs who are creating new dishes in their kitchens, who are trying to make the very, very best whatever that they can actually charge money for. You know, that's one of the things when you cook for yourself is you don't have that pressure. And same thing there, that when you are developing these recipes and thinking of completely new dishes, you are basically manipulating science, which I think is really cool because you don't necessarily think of it as science, but it's absolutely science.
Yeah. And I mean, when we talk about some of the scientific processes that are sort of going on, I think there are obvious things I think about, like when you apply heat to something, molecules change, proteins denature, you know, this is how things change shape, change color, change smell as you're cooking. But there are other processes that happen, like you have spent a lot of time in your research looking at the process of fermentation, right?
I love fermentation. Yeah. it's one of those, it's another one of those where I realized there's a connection to what I did in grad school, because I mentioned how I worked on small molecules and natural products. And of course, the molecules that are produced in fermentation are, you know, produced by microbes, and they determine how your fermented food turns out, your sauerkraut or your kimchi or your sourdough or whatever it is you're making. And by understanding what those molecules are, how they are produced, if we can tweak them even with some bioengineering, we can basically understand our fermented food better. So I think that's kind of part of the beauty too with food, is that all of science is there. It's definitely biology and chemistry, but then there's physics because of the material properties of the food. And there's math because of the various equations that can predict what happens in the food as we cook it. And there's math because of even just like in an ingredient list is math to some degree. So all of it is right there.
Yeah. And, you know, so far we've been sort of talking about this in a meta way. Like we're talking about the science without actually talking about the science. We're talking about the science. But in your book, you really do, which of course was co-authored with Michael Brenner and David Weitz. Is it pronounced Weitz?
Weitz, yes.
Weitz, okay. And David Weitz. You actually dive deep. You don't just talk about why science is cool. You actually dig into the science itself. And so I've got it right here in front of me, and I'm just looking once again at the table of contents so I can go back over how it's organized. You do kind of an intro chapter all about recipes and sort of, you know, getting us into the topic of science and cooking. And then you talk about these different aspects of the science underlying food and recipes: heat, charge, pH and enzymes, diffusion, texture, viscosity, elasticity. You talk about emulsions and foams. And then I love that you include a chapter on microbes and, you know, this, you know, aspect of fermentation, this aspect of, you know, cheese making, this aspect of beer making, but also just the way that there are living things that make our food what it is and why that's an important aspect of the science of food. There's so much to dive into here. I want to say one thing off the top is that for chapter 6, emulsions and foams, I always thought there was a reason that when you watch these shows about like molecular gastronomy, these very like fancy chefs making fancy foods, they love their foams and they love their emulsions. Is that because there's like a lot of science that goes into this?
Well, there is a lot of science, but also both emulsions and foams are, I think, way more common in food than a lot of us realize. You know, bread is kind of, you know, if we think of it at first, we're like, oh, foam. Well, sure, you whip a meringue and you turn the egg white into a foam. Okay, and maybe you think that's it, but bread is kind of a foam in a way. Sponge cake is a foam. Anything where there is air bubbles incorporated in a food is a foam. Popcorn is a foam in a way.
Oh yeah, mashed potatoes.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And emulsions, same thing there. You may just think, oh, right, maybe that hollandaise sauce I made, right, that's an emulsion, or my salad dressing, oil and water, mixing it. You add some mustard to stabilize it. Of course, that's an emulsion. But so many, you know, food often have a water component and they often have a fat component. And whenever you mix them, you are on some level making an emulsion. So I think there, and I think this is actually a theme in the book in general and in food and cooking in general, that there are sort of a few concepts. I don't know how I would say maybe there's like 10 concepts or so, maybe even less, that appear in very, very different foods. But the concept is the same and the science is the same. And by understanding a few of those concepts, you can kind of understand, you know, a fair number of different foods.
Yeah. And these themes are kind of recapitulated. And I have to say, I love that they're brought to life, not just in the sense that this is a beautiful, like, full color book that's really easy to read and conceptual, but because it's also tangible. You introduce recipes throughout the book, and oftentimes relatively simple recipes, but you don't just say, here's a thing, this is what you do with it. You say, here's a thing, this is how you make it the thing. Now let's explain and explore why these changes occur, why it is that at the end of the recipe, you end up with this gestalt that's, you know, different than the sum of the whole or the sum of the parts.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I'm glad you mentioned this thing about having some very simple recipes, which is true. I think probably one of the shortest recipes in the book may be the one on probably some of the ones in the microbes chapter, which is like sauerkraut or mead or something like that. You know, all you take two ingredients and then you mix them and then you wait. But then there are a few other recipes in this book where it's almost their length and their intricate nature is almost part of their beauty. And there are just all these little steps and there are ingredients in them that you wouldn't necessarily think of as ingredients in traditional recipes, but they do something. And this is usually the case for the recipes that are submitted by the chefs who have been speakers in the class and also contributing to the book. Some of those recipes, I would almost recommend that you don't make them, or should we say, I would be very, very impressed if you make them. In fact, for some of them, I may even be impressed if you find all the ingredients, but the point is sort of deeper than that. The point is, here is this thing and it's outlined in text form, and now visualize how it's all coming together and what it does. And really what I almost wish there really should be a complement to this book, which is, just watching the chefs make some of those recipes, because they are they're beautiful and sort of have a beauty of their own. Yeah.
I take it, for example, that the Amazonian recipes would fall into that category, where unless you kind of live near the rainforest and are able to get these fruits and these fishes, you're probably going to have a hard time producing these recipes.
That's correct. Yeah. That's the recipe from Virgilio Martinez from Central Restaurant in Peru. And the science concept, like many recipes, it shows many science concepts. The key one for that one is the concept of diffusion. But he does have, you know, he is kind of well known and famous for incorporating, really drawing on the very, very rich flora and fauna of Peru and the different elevations in Peru. And that definitely shows up in the recipe as well. So, yeah, so some of those will be tricky to find.
It's brilliant, though, that, you know, when you look at these images, you would expect, okay, most of the pictures in the book are just going to be pictures of finished food, but that's not the case at all. Not only do you have, you know, the types of schematics, the types of scientific illustrations showing a visualization of what's happening scientifically, that we might expect from even, I don't know, I don't want to say a textbook, because this is definitely not a textbook, but that you might expect in a textbook. But you also have these brilliant examples, these pictures of, for example, an apple core that's turned brown, or a piece of tuna that's been sliced and then soaked in lime juice for different periods of time, and a visualization of what happens to that tuna as it, quote unquote, cooks in the lime juice, you know, and illustrating the concept of diffusion. How quickly does this juice diffuse, and what does it do to the flesh of the tuna?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think our goal is kind of to really show how whatever happens on the microscopic scale, you know, the scale that you can't see with the naked eye, how whatever is going on there, whether it's, you know, denaturing proteins or various chemical reactions, Maillard reactions, but whatever it is that's going on, creating bubbles, right, in foams. But whatever it is, we can see it with the naked eye too, because it's also manifested on a macroscopic scale that we can see. So we've tried to really bring out some of the best labs and demos that we do in the class with the students, and put it together all in this little book. Yeah.
So tell me, as an instructor and as a scientist, maybe we can dig into the science a little bit. Maybe we can pick a couple of concepts that are out in front of your mind as sort of like the things you should be knowing if you're going to be cooking in your kitchen. Like, I can imagine that denaturing proteins is a pretty fundamental aspect of cooking.
Right. Certainly, denaturing proteins is a cool one. Although I would even say that there is an underlying scientific concept to that, because often even before the proteins start to denature, something has to happen. Like something has to happen that changes them. And often the scientific concept that underlies that is often the concept of diffusion. So when you cook a steak, right, you put your raw piece of meat on the griddle, and then the heat is going to diffuse into the steak. And as it does that, it's going to start to denature the proteins. It'll do other things as well, but that's kind of, in steak, that's one of the important things it does. Same thing when you are cooking ceviche, which you just mentioned. You put a piece of raw fish in lime juice, which is very acidic, has a low pH, and low pH turns out also denatures proteins. But in order for those for the proteins to even denature, the lime juice that is on the outside has to diffuse into the fish so that it can even have an effect on the proteins in the first place. So I think that is a concept, diffusion, that once you start thinking about it, it's all over. It's all over food, all over cooking.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of why it's so important, although I can tell you that myself, and I can assume that there are a handful of people listening who would be included in this group, why we don't often think about why things like cutting your food to be the same size before you cook it, or exactly. Like that's pretty important.
That's a great example, yeah.
Or not cooking everything on high heat, which is something I tend to do because I'm very impatient, which I know is like a cardinal sin in the kitchen, isn't it?
Right. No, exactly. I love that you bring up cooking things, you know, cutting things into the same size pieces. That's exactly because you want the heat to diffuse the same distance or whatever it is you're doing with it, if you're waiting for something to diffuse into it. But you want it to go the same distance in all of them. And that's so again, like the reason you do that, you know that you do that. And now you know why. Now you can be like, oh, right, diffusion.
Right. And also not just cutting things into the same size, but making sure that depending on how you're cooking it, you don't, I guess, overcrowd the pan. Like if you're trying to diffuse liquid, you want everything to be submerged in liquid. But if you're trying to diffuse heat, mm-hmm. and it's a function of things touching the metal of the pan, everything needs to touch the metal of the pan, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because we don't, it's like, I think in our heart of hearts, we know that there are scientific processes taking place, but it's so funny how how this is, how do I put it? It's almost like an intuitive science as opposed oftentimes to an explicit scientific exploration in most of our daily life. And as soon as we make explicit what we feel is intuitive, we can actually start stamping out the myths and understanding maybe why things work the way they do and why sometimes no matter what we do, it's not going to work that way.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's so true. And this fact that often it's an intuitive science, exactly. And it's people tend to know the answers. And chefs, you know, they will have done things a certain way, and it turns out they do it because there is a scientific reason for it. So I love that about this, that you can, by asking questions about the things you do know, and by asking questions about the things that you do observe, you know, what happens when you, when all the food pieces are not in direct contact with the pan, by asking questions about that, you can kind of figure out what is underlying and what is going on there. So that's very cool. And then I think another thing that is cool is the experimental component of this. You mentioned earlier introductory science classes, and you know, how do you teach introductory science classes? And I think a part of an emphasis is on how do you teach lab classes and experimental skills and scientific inquiry in starting with K-12 and through college. And you can do that with food as well. It's really an experimental science where you can find things out by doing the experiment. If you're asking yourself, what does baking soda do to the browning of an onion? You can find out, right? You can do it with the experiment and think about it.
Yeah, you know, when I was working on my master's degree, I did a master's in neurobiology. And so I found myself in the biology department, where I had previously always been in the psychology department. And now I'm back there for my PhD. But when I was in the bio department, I taught bio 101. I taught it, you know, multiple sessions per semester for the entire length of my master's and even for a year after. And I loved teaching. I taught the lab component of that course, which is pretty common in most universities, that the professors will teach the lecture and then the graduate students will often take the lab. And what I found was that it was almost unfair to the professors, because there were so many concepts that they would go and sit in this big lecture hall and they would, you know, hear the equations and they would hear the concepts. And you know, depending on the professor, sometimes they were really brought to life, other times they weren't. But then they would come into the lab and they would be like, ugh, I don't understand it. This is so confusing. I don't want to learn about, you know, these different really complicated concepts like respiration. And then you'd be like engaging in an experiment, and that's when you saw the light bulb go off. Like when you can see the fruits of your labor, when you can see the steps on paper coming to life and actually make the results happen as a function of your hand guiding them, it's such an incredible learning experience. I'm so glad that lab work is still fundamental to scientific education.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think that's where the learning really happens. It happens in the labs. And I think that's true whether you teach sort of traditional life sciences or you teach it with science and cooking. I definitely see that in our classes a lot. And I think with food, you have the additional bonus that this is then connected to your everyday life. So you can go home as a student and maybe you've just learned about heat transfer and you realize that, wait, this is what's going on here too. And this is what's going on in the dining hall food or anywhere else. So that's cool. That's great that you have that experience too.
Yeah. And I love that, because thinking back, we used food so often, not because we were cooking it per se, not because the kids were going to eat it afterwards, they were my age, but not because the students were going to eat it afterwards, but because food is such a readily available tool, right? It's easy to go out and buy spinach from the grocery store and then use spinach to teach chromatography or use spinach to teach about fluorescence or, you know, to do these different important, to teach these different important concepts in biology. There's so many core ingredients that you can find at the grocery store that help bring these concepts to life. And I love that crossover.
Yeah, it's true. We have now during remote learning, we have changed our labs so that students can do them in their kitchens. Mm. And the way we solve the lab materials issue is basically by sending everything to them with Amazon.
I love that.
which is lucky in a way. Every other science teacher is struggling with sourcing and shipping these quite complicated materials and equipment, and some of them are maybe you're not allowed to ship them, or they're very kind, or but Amazon always has things. I was going to say Amazon always has flour, but that is not true, because last spring it was a lot of students were doing projects on sourdough, and it was close to impossible finding flour for a while there in like April last year. So
you're right. So, who knew that the most popular pandemic activity early on in this would be sourdough starter? Like, so many people took up making sourdough. That must have been frustrating trying to source the materials, but so exciting as a professor to see that like the world is doing what we do in lab.
That's so true. It was funny, actually. There were students who knew they were quite far away from getting ingredients easily, so they wanted to choose something simple. So they were like, well, sourdough, flour and water is all you need. And then that turned out to be one of the hardest things of all.
It's so fascinating, though, that these, like we've been mentioning, these kind of fundamental tools can help us to understand these sometimes simple and sometimes pretty complex components of the scientific process, especially of the, I guess, material science or bioengineering processes. Of course, so often when we talk about food, what we're really talking about is living organisms. There are components of food that are not alive, obviously, salt, different molecules that we source not from living organisms, although we have salts in us too. But I'd love maybe to dive into some of the concepts as you studied biochemistry, and then that translated into your work as a professor, the concepts of that kind of the farm, the animal proteins, or the dairy products, or the plant matter, and how the biology of how these things grow and develop, and then later become our food, has, I don't know, worked its way into your understanding of this process?
That's a good question. And it is something, so being at this funny interface of science and the food world, where you get to notice the trends in the food world. And when this course started 10 years ago, there was a lot of hype around molecular gastronomy and using cool new technology in the kitchen, you know, using rotovaps and sous vide baths and you name it. And over the last 10 years, there has been a trend toward more interest in the various diversity in cuisine, sort of culturally around the world, but also more increasing emphasis, I would say, especially with what's going on with climate change, on the sort of the beginnings of the food system, right? What you were talking about. And I notice in my students more and more interest in that. Where do these things come from, and how does the food system affect these later processes? Of course, if you're focused on the materials, the material science and the chemistry and the biology of the foods, then it's easy to ignore that and spend less time talking about it. But it's definitely there. That's the thing with food, that there's kind of an interface with all of society, whether it's food system or with history, even the historical aspects of how we've cooked food, to politics, to so much. So it's a rich, rich subject for delving into all kinds of subjects. That doesn't really answer your question. I realize.
Well, in a way, I think it does. And it speaks to this idea, too, of this kind of closed system of energy, this idea that, food is fuel. It's so much more than fuel, but it's also fuel. And we, being kind of like high on a sort of trophic plane, we eat animals and plants who, eat other animals or plants, and eventually it gets down to the plants and it gets down to the sunlight. And this is a cycle that, this is the cycle of food as fuel. And it's interesting to think of the fact that many of these, I guess, macromolecules especially, but also some of these micro nutrients are passed down from organism to organism to organism based on the fact that we consume them. It's amazing that the kind of source materials that you yourself study, whether we're talking about complex proteins or simple salts, are gained and are utilized because we literally ate them. We ate something else that ate something else. It's such a fascinating cyclical process when you start to zoom out.
Yeah, no. That's so true. That's so true. I think that is another reason I like teaching about microbes, because microbes, of course, are also, they're living things, and the way they use certain food sources within the foods to get energy and to then produce various molecules, it sort of mirrors what goes on in all living organisms. How do we create ATP? How do we make energy? And what are the things that are produced in the process?
Yeah, so I'm interested too. We've been talking about this idea that food science is very multidisciplinary. So we've got the biological aspects, we've got the chemical aspects, we've got the social aspects, the historical aspects, the psychological aspects. And of course, there's the physics, and that's actually in the title of the book, Science and Cooking, Physics Meets Food, From Homemade to Haute Cuisine. And I love that too, From Homemade to Haute Cuisine, because that speaks to the very rustic or basic recipes that we can all make, and maybe the haute recipes that the fancy chefs put in there, where you're like, I'll learn about that, but I'm not going to attempt it. But going back to the question about physics, we're getting to the point where physics is chemistry and chemistry is biology, and it's almost hard to bucket these things from a taxonomic perspective like we used to be able to in science's early days. But what is it, given that caveat, what is it about physics that you and your co-authors felt like this is so important that we're going to put this on the cover? We're not going to talk about the biology of food. We're not going to talk about the chemistry of food. We're going to talk physics of food.
That's a good question. I think because we felt that is something that has been done much less. So using chemistry, using food and cooking as a way to teach chemistry has some history. If you look in the literature, there are people who have been teaching reactions and kinetics with baking soda and that's just one example, but that has a little bit more of a history. This idea that there are chemical reactions in food, and we can look at them to understand how they work. Physics, and especially the idea of soft matter physics, which is the physics that happens in all soft materials. So your cheeks, your hands, the steak. Anything that is kind of soft and bendable is a soft material. And there are certain physical concepts that kind of govern how they behave. So one of the chapters in the book is called Texture, Viscosity, and Elasticity, which is all the physics that goes on in the texture in a food. And to some degree, that can be explained by chemistry, but you also need some of these physical concepts to explain it. And it's a big part of food. You know, food is essentially, simply speaking, it's flavor and texture. And emulsions and foams have a certain texture. You know, a liquid material can be more or less viscous. It can stick more or less to your tongue. It can be sort of drippy or clumpy or whatever. So it's an important part of what food is.
Yeah, of course. It's so true. And I don't think we often give texture its due, but it's true that there are foods, for example, that I like because of their texture, or I don't like because of their texture. And I think everybody can speak to that, where the food might have the exact same flavor, but if the texture's off, like talk about stale chips or stale crackers, if the texture is off and it's too bendy and it doesn't have that snap or that bite, all of a sudden, even though it tastes the exact same, it's inedible to us. It's something we wouldn't even want to put in our mouths. I think that I'm trying to remember which book it was, and I'm not sure if you've read it, but Mary Roach, it was either in, I think, Gulp or in Packing for Mars. She does a deep dive. Oh, no, you know what? I think it was in Grunt. I think it was in her book about military science. She does a kind of a deep dive into, or maybe Gulp, because that one's about the alimentary canal, into the texture of food and kind of the end user experience, you know, the very human psychology side of it, and how cool that that's complemented by, in your book, by the deep kind of physics of texture and what is happening at the molecular level to produce a crispness, to produce a softness, a foaminess, a different mouthfeel. You know, we hear about that term mouthfeel in cooking and gastronomy, and, you know, even sommeliers talk about mouthfeel, but it's so important.
It's hugely important. Yes. I was just thinking, if I think back to the foods that I really could not stand as a kid, it often had more to do with texture than it did with flavor. You know, these weird textures that just feel weird and gummy. That's very true. Very true.
Yeah. And a lot of that, I think, too, comes down to many of us have these bad memories of like certain foods not being cooked in a way that we prefer them. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Texas, mm-hmm. and I didn't think I liked green beans when I was a kid, because I was used to a very Texas way of cooking green beans, which is to cook them way down with usually a chicken broth or some sort of meat base until they become like mushy. And now, of course, I steam them and I might even pan fry them, or they're always crispy, or not crispy, but at least they have a crunch. They have a snap when I eat them. And that it's almost like it's a completely different food.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or French fries. French fries that are fresh and just a few hours later. Huge difference.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. Thank goodness for the air fryer. Now you can always put them right back in. Right. An air fryer, by the way, is just a convection oven, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's all it is, right? A small convection oven that heats up really fast.
Right. Yeah.
and that's an interesting thing too, that we don't often think about is, you know, when it comes to science, one of the fundamental principles that I think is not out in front in our teaching, but is so obvious when you take a little bit of a bird's eye view, is the sort of synergy between scientific processes and scientific methodology and tools. So often in science, the reason that we see revolutions in the way that we think about things is because somebody was able to stumble upon or invent a tool that then allowed us to do it. We think about gravitational waves, and there's a whole new form of physics that's opened up by the discovery of gravitational waves. We think about, you know, even back in the day, microscopes, telescopes, CRISPR, for example, like allowing us to now do things with the science, with our scientific methodology that we couldn't previously do. That's kind of the same with cooking, right? Like there's a lot you can do with very basic things in your kitchen, but if you get the right tool for the job, you're able to really open up a world to yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, that's very true. I think the tool that comes to mind right away is the sous vide stick, which is a very novel invention, It goes back several decades, but for a long time it wasn't just sold as a stick. It was an actual temperature bath, sort of a big bath that was kept at a certain temperature, and it was quite expensive. And so later on, it became something chefs did in their kitchens. And it's relatively recent that you can just buy one of those sticks on Amazon, and you can make your own 64-degree perfectly cooked egg at home. And that's an amazing experience for many people. It's like the kind of egg that is would otherwise be very hard to make. And in some cases, if you cook meat that way, maybe it's the kind of steak you've just never had before. You know, it's a perfectly cooked steak with a correct, with a certain temperature all the way through. So that's very true. Sometimes tools can really allow us to do things that we couldn't do before, and allow us to have experiences that we couldn't have before.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible to think about that. The fact that, you know, that's a good example of like a piece of technology that really opens up, that really opens up a type of cooking that we would have never been able to do. And even simpler things like, I don't know, for example, I just moved into a new house. Like 2 years ago, I think. And my house was already built. And so it came with the stove that it came with. And it's a gas stove. So many people talk about how much they love cooking over fire. I personally hate it. I take issue. I've been reading a lot more about indoor air pollution and, you know, just climate change in general. And apparently having an open flame in your house is actually not very healthy. But a lot of people love cooking over gas. I miss my induction cooktop. My old house had an induction cooktop, and it was a game changer for me. And for whatever reason, they're not very common here in the States. I don't know if you've noticed that. Most people don't have them in their homes. But for me, having that kind of control was just incredible compared to just an open flame, where high is a bigger flame and low is a smaller flame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't think I've ever lived in a house that had that. That's
no, yeah, we had to put one in.
That you miss your old stove.
I do. It's like it changes the way I cook for sure. Although there are some benefits to having an open flame. Like I can throw my tortillas on there and they always turn out amazing.
Right. That's true.
Well, Pia, gosh, there's so much here. There's so much more that we could dive into, from the very, very basics of, of what's going on at the molecular level, all the way to these big takeaways, everything from changing pH to adding heat to affecting the growth and development of microbes, and looking at the byproducts or the waste products that they put off as a form of our food. You really dive deep into exactly why food does what it does under these different circumstances. And I hope that everybody will pick up the book, because not only can you read it as a start to finish kind of reference and along the way you can cook, but you can also utilize the book the way that you would utilize a cookbook. You can find a recipe in there that's interesting to you, and then you can read around the recipe and dive into the science behind what's actually happening as you go through that recipe start to finish. There's so much valuable information. This book really allows you, I think, to be that lurking Harvard student who maybe wouldn't be able to take your course, but can now take your course in book form. I've got a few more things I'd love to dive into with you, but before we kind of close up with my final questions, I was wondering if there's anything that we didn't touch on, anything that you feel like you would be remiss if we didn't get to it.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay, great. Well, then I am so curious. I always end my episodes by asking my guests the same two questions. And you're the first person I've ever had on the show to talk about the science of food, I think. Gosh, I hope I'm not misremembering somebody, but yeah, I think this is the first time that I've done a deep dive into this topic. And so I'm going to be fascinated to see where your personal perspectives play out in my final two questions. So they're really big picture questions. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Are you ready for that?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. So when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you. It could be very personal, it could be, career related, or it could be a bigger picture with regards to humanity, with regards to the planet, or even the cosmos. The first question is kind of the bummer question. And that is, what is the thing that really is keeping you up at night, is, possessing you, is making you really concerned? What is the thing that you're maybe pessimistic, not hopeful for? And then on the flip side of that, so we end on a little bit of a lighter note, what are you genuinely and authentically optimistic about? What are you kind of truly looking forward to?
There are many levels to these things, right? There are many levels to, and they're different in the different ways that you worry about them. I would think that some of the largest threats facing humanity, and there are several, but I think some things that we have to figure out is the issues that relate to climate change and the food system. And I kind of lump them together because that happens to be the field in which I hang out. What makes me feel optimistic and excited often tend to be cool new solutions to problems, whether that's the microbiome or climate change or even a different way for us to talk to each other as human beings. I worry that I'm going too philosophical, but if one of the things I often think about in my teaching is how to keep the curiosity that brought students to my classroom in the first place. I think it's not uncommon that students are curious about something, or just young people, or all of us in general, and we show up to try to learn about it. And then there is something that sort of cuts us off. And I think it's especially sad when that happens within educational institutions. And I think there is something about that curiosity and about keeping that alive that I think is important in a classroom, but that I'm also, being very philosophical, that I'm also hopeful about is something that can help us be optimistic about solving these problems that we face as humanity, and sort of on a big scale and a small scale.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said about this fundamental human curiosity and ingenuity that it feels like, regardless of the difficulty, and I'm sure there is a spillover point, right? I'm sure there's a threshold by which, if we were living under, a really authoritarian rule, that would be suppressed sort of to a place that it was no longer flourishing. But luckily, living in, living under democracy, a representative republic, whatever you want to call it, even with the problems that we're facing, and those problems are a many, there's still this fundamental human curiosity that seems to be fostered regardless of your political party, regardless of your take on third rail issues. The human spirit, the ability to solve problems, is something that kind of humanity is good at, we're proud of. And I think that it will persist. I think that it will continue to persist, and it'll be a driving force even in the face of tremendous obstacles.
Yeah, that's very nicely put.
Sort of. Like, I wouldn't want to see a transcript of what I just said. Be a little bit rambling.
I think education has a very important role in that, in both in fostering that curiosity, but also sort of reaping the rewards that come from it, which is people learning about the world around us and sort of digging in to solve problems. So
You're so right. And I think not to kind of co-opt here, but it feeds back for me onto one of my biggest concerns, one of my biggest, you know, worries and pessimisms is that we don't give education the proper funding. We don't give education its proper due. And more, and I know that this happens in waves. This is not a new problem, but at least specific to the American mentality, we are seeing a kind of culture war against education, against expertise, and against knowledge, that somehow going to college or getting an advanced education is not, for some people, not always something to be proud of, not always something to promote. And that really bums me out. Like, it bums me out. I would love to live in a society where no matter what your political affiliation is, no matter what your religious persuasion, your cultural or ethnic persuasion, that learning is a universal goal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Pia, I think that your book is a welcome and fascinating insight, a welcome and fascinating tool that we can use to learn. I think even if you know, don't know anything about these scientific concepts, if you don't even remember the biology class you took way back in high school, even if you never finished high school, you can pick up this book and you can rekindle a love for cooking, and you can learn a lot about why the stuff that happens in your kitchen is so damn interesting. And I absolutely thank you for taking the time today to share with us the insights and the knowledge, even just a little taste of them that you get to share with the students who take your courses. So thank you so much for that today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Of course. And everybody listening, I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.